from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, July the 30th, 2020, and we've got a good show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking first about a debate in Vermont that occurred a few years ago, is now happening in the at the federal court level, and that is concerns labeling of food that has been genetically engineered. And the Trump administration's Department of Agriculture came out with some rules on that, and the rural Vermont is among the groups that is suing because they don't like those rules. We're going to be finding out from Carolyn Gordon of Rural Vermont in just a moment what that's all about. In the second half hour of the program this morning, we've been trying to bring in some of the leading candidates for statewide office as the as time winds down toward the August 11th primaries. They're only less than 2 weeks away now. It's 12 days, I guess. And today we're speaking with Rebecca Holcomb. She's a Democratic candidate for governor, of course, former Vermont Education Secretary, and we'll be speaking with her in the second half hour of the show today. Later on, we're trying out a new segment here, see how it goes, and maybe make it a series if it's, it turns out to be fun. I'm calling it That's a Thing, and this week we are going to be talking about veterinary acupuncture. Interesting conversation lined up in the second hour on that topic. I had never heard of it until a week or so ago when another guest mentioned it on the air, and I said, that's a thing? So that's the genesis of this whole idea. And we love the idea also of you emailing suggestions for that segment, because I want to make it a regular thing if we can. It's send us a note at dgshow at radiovermont.com if you have something that you think would be fun to hear about on the air under the category. It's a pretty broad category, but it just has to be something that's a little quirky, maybe, called That's a Thing, or That's a Thing question mark, I think is more likely what we're looking at here. All righty. Well, let's go to Carolyn Gordon of Rural Vermont to talk about this lawsuit that the group announced they are participating in yesterday. And Carolyn, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You are joining a national group, and I'm wondering if there are other local groups that are involved with this, you know, sort of statewide organizations like yours, or is it Rural Vermont and the, I believe it's called the Center for Food Safety that are carrying the weight or the water on this right now?
That's right. So Rural Vermont is part of a federal coalition of food labeling nonprofits that are plaintiffs in this case. I don't believe that CFS was able to find other representatives from Vermont, even though, of course, the food movement in Vermont was altogether highly involved in passing the original GMO labeling law in Vermont. But for this specific lawsuit, it was just a matter of efficiency for CFS to have one major leading organization like ours representing Vermont for this lawsuit.
And the lawsuit alleges what specifically?
So the lawsuit challenge is challenging the Trump administration's USDA implementation of the federal GE labeling law, which the USDA now calls bioengineered food. Mm-hmm. So aside from the term being confusing, the lawsuit also challenges that the USDA rules only make the information from the label accessible to those that scan QR codes with their smartphone, and that they do not include many high-processed foods in the new standard for consumer information.
So you would rather see a clear label on the food that falls into this category that says it is GMO or GE, standing for genetically engineered, and that you think this is insufficient, basically?
Yeah, basically requiring a smartphone discriminates at least against about 20% of the American adult population, primarily poor, elderly, rural, and minority populations, who just have lower percentages of smartphones ownership or live in an area like Lower Vermont in which grocery stores do not have internet bandwidth. And also for those of us with smartphones, I think it is extremely burdensome to expect someone to take the time to research information hidden behind a QR code for every product one considers buying. And that, of course, is just even more so the case during a pandemic like the current one.
Yeah, you know, one thing that you hear a lot from people who are basically defending GE foods and or GMO foods is that they are very, very common in the marketplace out there. It's, you really have to kind of work if you wanted your weekly shopping not to include this kind of food, and that there's really no harm here, et cetera. And I've always had a hard time sort of separating out the question of, you know, kind of the substance of, you know, what is the food, how is it made? That's one question. And another question is, should there be a label on the food to indicate that it is made in a certain way? I mean, it's sort of like are we debating the substance of the matter, as in how the food is made, or are we debating just how it should be labeled and what information should go to the consumer?
Yeah, so of course a label is basically a tool for the consumer's right to know, and then for the consumer to have the responsibility and the ability to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
And surely for many consumers that is more about a decision that they don't want to support production practices associated with genetically engineered organisms. And they can only make that decision when that information is transparent. And this is basically, from a regulatory law regime, the free market model of putting that decision-making authority into consumers' hands rather than the state saying certain production practices are not sustainable or bad for the biodiversity or harmful for farmers' rights to safe seeds or whatever you want to put as a value system behind this decision-making. And if you want to stick with free market solutions to our societal pressing environmental issues, then having transparent and clear labeling is a major step for achieving that.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the ironies here that I've always, you go into a supermarket, a typical supermarket, and you're going to find there's just a ton of information on all sorts of boxes and cans and et cetera. You can go in and you can find out whether your tomato sauce includes, includes, you know, peppers or garlic, or, I mean, there's all these different flavors of tomato sauce. Apparently, there's a lot of information that the companies seem to want to give you. You know, are the crackers the original version of the cracker, or are they the cheddar dill version of the cracker, et cetera? And so there's just all this information that flows into the consumer's brain while the consumer is wandering up and down the supermarket aisles. But for some reason, this is something that people have really resisted having this kind of information available to the person who's wandering up and down the supermarket aisles. What do you think the reason is for that difference?
Oh, no, I don't think that people have resisted. I think that people have been demanding this for over two decades.
Okay, now. But I mean people being, you know, the industry, the manufacturers have, many of them have resisted this idea and have formed groups like Bio, you know, the groups that oppose labeling. So, I mean, I've always wondered, if you can tell me the thing has cheddar dill versus, you know, paprika or something, why can't you tell me whether it's from a genetically engineered process?
Of course, the industry is very much afraid of consumers' power to decide that they don't want to buy products that are genetically engineered. And that's why there's this greenwashing campaign of the USDA's rules and avoiding the term GE or GMO, terms that have been established for over 25 years by science, education, advocacy, media campaigns that manage to associate with the terms what people now understand as the background of this whole issue. And now USDA said, okay, we label this as bioengineered and give it a smiley face just to avoid people associating what they currently associate with it and then potentially avoiding that consumers make the decision that the industry is afraid of.
Yeah, I just find it's kind of odd that there is this different approach to the information that is shared with consumers out there. What do you see as the biggest? What do you and the Center for Food Safety see as the biggest problems connected with the current rules? What's the word they're using? Bioengineered foods. Couldn't people learn over time that means genetically modified, or that means? It wouldn't even take very long for somebody to go, oh, bioengineered. That means if I'm trying to avoid GMO foods, then I don't want to buy that.
Yes, of course, over time people would be able to adapt, but at the beginning it's confusing. And not just that, there was required to have, in terms of the QR code, you know, that's not even a term visible on the package. That's just a pattern that you would have then to scan with your smartphone that would then reveal the information digitally as far as you have the app, of course, and the internet connection to access that information. And there was a study required to see whether that is a practical way of implementing the law. And actually, that study, CFS had a successful lawsuit in 2018 against the USDA to reveal the result of that study. And that study actually showed that it was actually problematic. And yet, USDA decided to move forward, and at first not even to publish that information. And now the rules, package everything in these QR codes. So that's a huge issue. Aside from the confusing term bioengineered. And then the third thing that we challenge is that most high-processed foods don't have to meet the requirement at all. And, of course, for many consumers that don't buy raw products to cook at home, most consumers buy pre-processed foods, and many of those are not even covered by the labeling law. By the labeling rules. They are covered by the law, but not by the labeling rules.
Right. Okay. All these words, all these phrases have similar definitions, Carolyn Gordon. What is the unifying way people should think about this? What is a genetically modified or bioengineered food?
That's basically a term that refers we don't see it necessarily as a health term, but it is a term that refers to how the agricultural practice that has grown the food, what that is. So crops that are genetically engineered means that basically the genetics of the seed that grows into that crop was modified. Mm-hmm. And that is associated with private rights associated with that seed, and that that diminishes sort of the sovereignty of small farmers in particular that traditionally used to grow the crops from their own seed, and basically centralizes that power of the seed market to corporate players, major corporate players like Monsanto and the like, or Bayer now.
So the main impact here on the health of the shopper in the supermarket and the shopper's family, or is the main impact here on farmers? Or if you were to give a percentage of impacts to each, how would you divide that up?
Well, you know, there's also been science and discussion about the health implications of this, but for Rural Vermont as a advocacy organization for small farmers and community-scale agriculture, for us this is an issue about food sovereignty. We want our small farmers, vegetable growers in particular, to be able to cultivate their own seeds. And, you know, that has something to do with their sovereignty and independency and, at the latest, their own farm viability. But also, of course, we are convinced that a seed grown in a region and recultivated in a region over time has the right properties to nourish the local population the best. So, but, you know, I would say science also is not quite there yet in proving us what actually the health implications of this philosophy, I would say, are.
Yeah, I know this is a huge issue. I had a guest on several months ago who was actually from India and had been working in sort of rice diversity over there. They grow an awful lot of rice in India, of course, and there was a lot of concern there that some of the more localized types of rice, which really are geared to what has worked best for farmers in specific regions over, you know, centuries, were being kind of dominated out of the market by rice which was preferred by international rice shippers. And this is the kind of issue we're talking. We're getting into real agricultural economics here, and I understand that there's a lot of concern about kind of getting farmers on what some of the advocacy groups I've heard refer to as a treadmill of needing to go back to the same companies year after year to buy the same inputs, the same same seed and the same fertilizer, et cetera.
Let us take the rice example. Let's expand on that just a little bit, if I may.
Sure.
You know, it's very a good visible example. Just imagine all the rice farmers had all their individual locally grown crops for decades and centuries, and then one of a sudden a centralized company says, "Hey, take this genetically engineered seed. It guarantees a certain growth of the crop and a certain yield of the crop." And the farmers are attracted to that idea and go with that seed. But then everywhere, one of a sudden, the plant is basically not individual anymore. The plant is like a clone. There's all the same plants, you have to imagine, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean for the resiliency of that crop? It's also detrimental because if a weather event, for example, or a pest impacts this crop despite its promise to not to do so, one of a sudden all the yields are wasted, and it's not the same resiliency of growing a diversity of crops.
But the downside of crop diversity from the point of view of, I think, of a lot of food marketers is they want to be able to guarantee consumers week after week when you buy that box of cereal, you are going to get the same thing you got last week. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be a batch of rice that came in from a different farmer with a slightly different method, and it's got more, I don't know, a different texture or something, right?
That's part of it. The uniformity for having a uniform marketplace is another corporate interest. But we say, you know, what we have as a counterculture here also in Vermont with multiple CSAs, farmers markets, and so on, is a culture that is based on the relationship to your producers, and that is a relationship that is nourishing in so many more ways than just having an appealing shape and size of your cucumber.
All right, we have a listener calling in, John on the road. Good morning, John.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good. Hey, Carolyn, I've seen, as a consumer, I love good food, and I try to stay away from, you know, genetically modified things. And if I'm a label, it will clearly state non-GMO. And, you know, that, as a consumer, I say, hey, I'd rather use that than something that was modified by Monsanto or someone. But isn't aren't a lot of things in nature hybridized from, you know, say a bee takes pollen from one plant and you know, or one crop and then goes to another similar crop but pollinates, and then you end up getting, you know, things that are GMO by nature. Is that the same, or am I thinking of something totally different?
Carolyn, what do you say to that? I mean, I think what John's getting at is that there has been a lot of, as he says, cross-pollination over the centuries. There has been a lot of people trying to breed a better, you know, ear of corn or whatever. But genetic engineering is something different, right?
Totally. It's basically how I understand it, and don't get me wrong, I'm definitely not a biologist by any means, so don't take it totally for granted what I know about this, but genetic engineering basically means that you also, to some degree, leave the pollinators aside, because basically what the plant needs to grow, especially, the commodity crops we grow in genetic engineering, like corn, for example, they are pollinating with the wind anyway, so the bee example doesn't really touch on that, but to some degree, we with genetic engineering put into the human power what was originally more part of a ecosystem function, where farmers interacted with the services that, for example, pollinators provide, and, you know, as you said, carrying pollen from one plant to another, and now we, you know, equip that crop, that seed in the laboratory basically with what it needs and send it out to the field. But for some genetic engineered crops, pollinators still play a role in pollinating and producing the fruit in the end. It's not the same. Basically really, you know, what was originally possible for crops that would be, I forget the English term, but, there's hybrid seeds and then there's open pollinating seeds. And open pollinating seeds means you can basically have pollinators pollinate from tomato to tomato, and then you can harvest the tomato, and as a home gardener, you can take the seed from your own tomato because it's open pollinated. And as soon as you have a hybrid seed, which is, I don't know if it's categorically belongs into the GE thing, that's, I think it's another thing, but just to exemplify what I mean, you could never grow a hybrid seed that you take from your own tomato plant, because it would basically, when it regrows, it splits up the genetic information it carried from its hybrid mother plant. And then what you get in the end is something very different from what you would expect. It doesn't make the nice fruit that you would expect. So open pollination, if you're a home gardener and you plant your own garden, looking for seeds that are open pollinated would allow you to have this sovereignty that we touched on here.
Got it. Well, Caroline Gordon, I hate to say this, but we got to wrap it up because we're about at the bottom of the hour here. I got to go to some CBS News. But I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning. John, thank you for the call, and we're going to go to that CBS News break, couple words from sponsors. Back in a couple of minutes, we'll be talking to Rebecca Holcomb, one of the Democratic candidates for governor running in the August 11th primary. Back in a few, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program this morning. We have an interesting conversation, I think, coming right up here with Rebecca Holcomb. She is a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor running in the August 11th primary. I'm sorry, she's a Democratic candidate for governor running in the August 11th primary. I had a couple of lieutenant gubernatorial candidates on the air yesterday. I knew I would do that today, and I apologize to our listeners and to Rebecca Holcomb, who's my next guest. She's running for governor in the August 11th primary, and Rebecca Holcomb, welcome to our program this morning.
Thank you, and thank you for making sure I'm on the right track. I'm running for governor, not lieutenant governor.
You're running for governor, not lieutenant governor, and it has been a strange campaign to launch your first bid for statewide office, in this era of the COVID-19 crisis. So I want to ask you first off, what has been the weirdest aspect of that?
Well, you know, Dave, first of all, thank you for having me here today. It's a pleasure to hear your voice in person again, remotely. You know, I got to say, I'm not a lifelong politician, so I haven't been around doing this for 24 years. I'm just someone who's running because it feels like an urgent time to do so, and the state has real challenges and needs real solutions. And the other thing is I started a long time ago. I started in July because I knew as a first-time candidate I need to get out early and have a chance to meet people in their communities and in their homes. And, you know, as a first-time candidate, I got to say politics is just weird. So I don't know that COVID any different than anything else.
Yeah, okay.
But the real privilege has been meeting people. And I'm just so grateful to Vermonters from the north to the south who've opened their doors, who've opened their Zoom accounts and invited me in to hear what's on their mind and give me their ideas for what we could do to be a better state full of opportunity and, you know, the nice future that we all deserve.
Well, you are a former secretary of the State Agency of Education, and one of the big issues right now in Vermont, I mean, really front and center for an awful lot of folks, is what is going to happen with our schools this fall as they try to reopen. Some are doing so in a sort of hybrid way. Some are doing so in a more aggressive in-school way. Some are doing so more relying a little more on, remote learning. Where do you come down on all that? And what are your chief concerns about trying to get school back up and running this fall?
Well, the first thing I just want to do is I want to acknowledge what we are asking our school communities to do. And the first thing I would just say is, I was talking to a school superintendent earlier today, and she was talking about how she hasn't been sleeping, just the stress has been so significant. And I just want to honor the responsibility so many of our educators feel when they feel that the lives of their staff and their students are really in their hands in many ways, in the middle of so much uncertainty, and I know it feels overwhelming. And I just want them to know how much gratitude I feel, and to just remind all of us that opening up schools again isn't actually something schools can do on their own. Whether they're child cares or independent schools or public schools, it's something we all do as communities, because if COVID comes back into our communities, it puts all of our schools at risk. And so all of us need to be doing everything we can, whether it's wearing our masks aggressively, you know, avoiding congregating inside in social ways that can spread transmission, quarantining when we come in from out of state, just to make sure that we're keeping our communities safe. And, you know, with respect to the specific opening, I put out guidance and people can go to my website or look online. And, I think the reality is that the expertise in public health is at the state level, and there's lots of tricky logistics that really need to be coordinated if we don't want to have workforce shortages as we head into the effort to open up. What I would say is that I think every community needs to be prepared to operate online entirely because we might have a surge. It could be prepared to open up in person entirely, and that will be possible probably in some of our communities. But it also needs to be prepared to be hybrid, and it will be different in different communities, not because people didn't do their job, but just different circumstances, different physical plans, different characteristics and staff will mean we'll have to have flexibility and creativity. And my hope is that the state can step up and do some coordination and help plan in a systematic and organized way that both honors and respects the reality that our people who work in our schools are older on average than people working in schools in other states. Many of them are people with caretaking responsibilities or fit the CDC guidelines for being at risk in the face of COVID, but also acknowledges the incredible need of young people, and particularly some of our most vulnerable young people, students with disabilities, students for whom their homes may not be safe, students who really need schools for the supports that they provide, our youngest learners who really, you know, are at risk if they lose a critical year of their education, and some of our teenagers who have emotional needs to connect with their peers. We need to figure out creative ways to meet these needs so that our young people are cared for and can continue to be developed and healthy, and also that parents can get back to work. And it's going to take coordination at the state level. It's going to take careful, methodical planning and very quick response from the Department of Health in the event of any potential surge.
Our number here is, local number is 244-1777. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 for those who want to check in and maybe ask a question or make a comment to Rebecca Holcomb, a Democratic candidate for governor. By the way, another Democratic candidate for governor will be joining us tomorrow on the Dave Graham Show. Dave Zuckerman will be on in this same time slot tomorrow morning. So we're trying to cover as much ground as we can here in the last 12 days of the primary season here in Vermont. Of course, the primary, the official election day is August 11th, and Secretary of State Jim Condos was on the program earlier this week asking that everybody who can mail in those, get those mail-in ballots in early. They're trying to avoid lines at the polls because lines are not conducive to social distancing necessarily. Let's go to a caller we have on checking in this morning, Tim from Rochester. Good morning, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. I have a question about the Act 46 statute.
Mm-hmm.
In November of 2017, Rebecca was still supporting Act 46. In March of 2018... that changed for some reason. And my question is, Secretary of Education is only one agency in the whole state. The state of Vermont has very, very many issues that need to be addressed. And if we've got somebody that's in an appointed position as Secretary of Education supporting a statute and bill in November of 17 and then isn't in 2018, takes the BOE board chair with them for their campaign, and things aren't even finished yet with Act 46. My specific question is, where's the leadership that's going to be given to the whole state if there isn't leadership in one agency? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Tim. By the way, Act 46, of course, was the law passed, I think, 3 or 4 years ago now, relating to having school governance consolidated in the state of Vermont. Tim seems to think you flipped your position there in a few months. Rebecca Holcomb, what do you say?
Well, just to be clear, it was actually passed in 2015, and then the fix to Act 46 was sponsored by David Zuckerman, actually, so the caller should call back tomorrow as well, and that was passed in 2016. You know, this was a complicated bill, and when you're Secretary of Education in the executive branch, we're still a state of rule of law, and our job is to support the law as written, and I did support Act 46 implementation and worked with districts to the extent possible to make sure that we could help them do what they did. I did leave before the final phase of Act 46. Part of my concern had to do with the fact that the governor had twice vetoed budgets or proposed to veto budgets and get them undone after voters had locally voted. And it became very difficult to work in a coherent way to implement a law in good faith with school boards. And certainly in Rochester, I know it was a painful conversation. They voted several times and changed what they chose to do, ending up, I hope, with a solution that they feel was the best possible alternative for them under Act 46. But I think the other issue is the important one, and that's why am I qualified to be governor and why am I the most qualified person running in this primary? And here's the reality. I've been working in public institutions my entire life with very diverse boards to figure out how to bring people together around budgets, which are how we work together as communities and a state to put in place the things that we feel are important to make our state healthy and strong for families. At the education agency, of course, I had to report to an independent state board. I reported to the governor, and often they disagreed. But the reality is, I have strong state-level experience. I took over an agency that had had a 40% cut in its state funding, figured out how to rebuild a staff that had been demoralized by losses, and make us punch above our weight and get the job done for Vermonters in a way that was consistent with state law, but really helped people get work done when they needed to at the local level. And I'm proud of that record, and there isn't anyone else running who's had that experience. And that's what we're going to need as we look at a $550 million shortfall, and we have to figure out how to commit ourselves to our goal of making sure everybody is safe, everybody has a fair chance, and doing so in a way that's going to feel pretty fiscally tight in the next couple of years. There's nobody else who's had that experience. There's nobody else who's been part of budgeting for over a third of our state's expenditures, or almost, and there's no one else who's worked closely with agencies from the Agency of Commerce, Community Development, Department of Labor, transportation from the administrative side to work to get the job done and get good policies in place that keep Vermonters well.
The my guess is Rebecca Holcomb. She's a Democratic candidate for governor, and I laugh a little bit because I got that wrong right at the beginning of the segment here. Apologies again. Let's see. We have another call coming in. Don from Elmore is on the line. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. A question for me, please. Vermont now has, as I understand it, an average student cost of $19,000 per year. And the U.S. average is $12,500. What does she propose to start bringing Vermont education costs in line with the rest of the country before we price ourselves out of it completely? I'm well reminded of the $30 million that Madeline Cunin got the legislature to borrow from the Highway Trust Fund years ago that has never been repaid, and has left our roads from being the best in the northern New England to now the worst, and yet we're still pouring money down education costs as if it were an unending problem. It's like trying to fill a spot of quicksand. That's what I feel about it. And I'd like to know what her thoughts are on trying to do something about it, because I really don't think she did that much when she was in the education department. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, Don. Rebecca Holcomb, it sounds like we have a voter out there in Elmore wants to rein in education spending. What do you say to Don?
Well, thank you for the call. And I think what the caller is speaking to is the fact that property taxes have gone up, and people are concerned about that. Actually, they've been increasing much faster since I left office. Just have to put that out there, because the facts suggest that actually we were pretty effective at working with school districts to bring the cost down. But first thing we need to talk about is the fact that much of what we've stuck in our education funding isn't really school spending the way other states count school spending. So you really can't compare Vermont to New Hampshire, for example, because a lot of human services in Vermont are delivered through schools in ways that make it look like we're spending more on education than our neighbors are, but it's just that it's paid for someplace else in New Hampshire. So you really have to be careful with those kinds of comparison. The other is, when we talk about education spending per pupil, we often forget that the education fund pays for a lot of kids who aren't in our public schools, including kids in child cares and daycares, and including kids who are in private schools, including independent schools in other states. And when you throw in all of those students, it actually brings down our cost of education quite substantially. In terms of issues that I would address, the first thing I'd do is take out of the education fund things that don't strictly belong to schools and that school districts can't manage. For example, one of the biggest drivers of increased cost in our education fund right now is mental health services for kids. In other states, these come out of our state budget. It's actually more progressive if you do it that way. It is driving up our property taxes, but it's also something that school boards can't manage and control. We need to invest in a strong mental health system that's community-based and can support families so families can take care of kids. Because when we spend those dollars in our school budget, we can take care of kids, but families still aren't getting the care they need. And that means we end up paying twice. So we need to rethink what we pay for in schools and what we pay for in other budgets as well. And the single biggest driver of cost in our education increase this year is healthcare. And across the state, you know, year after year, what we're seeing is, you know, qualified plans, 12%, 14% increases in the cost of healthcare. It's not just school districts, it's municipalities as well. I talked to the mayor of Montpelier just after she found out that their premiums were going up 25% in 1 year. We need healthcare solutions. I put out a set of recommendations to bring down the cost of healthcare and improve access statewide just yesterday. And by taking on healthcare, which school boards no longer negotiate because it's done by the administration, I will be able to bring down your property taxes. And those are the kinds of issues I'm going to do focus on that will lead to real, sustained, long-term solutions for Vermonters, not one-time budget games and using surplus funds and one-time money to pretend we're buying down tax rates. Vermonters know we need real solutions, and that's what I'm going to focus on.
I do want to talk about a couple of other topics aside from education. I know that's your background, so we can definitely spend more than the half hour we have here on that subject alone. But here's a question for you. There's been a rolling debate in Vermont over recent years. It's waxed and waned in different ways, but it really connects to the degree to which state law and local law enforcement in the state of Vermont should cooperate with federal authorities, the Immigration Customs Enforcement folks, Border Patrol, et cetera, in terms of apprehending people who are in the country illegally. And I want to ask you, to what degree do you think Vermont law enforcement, local and or state, should be cooperating with the federal authorities on this front?
You know, and this is an issue where I've spoken out strongly before. So you may recall, Dave, that I wrote a memo instructing schools that our young people, including students who are here who are undocumented, have a right to education that is protected by the Supreme Court. This is a constitutional right. And I suggested that schools not collect information that could be used to identify these students, because they have a right. It is protected, again, by a Supreme Court decision. And when we collect information that can be used to, you know, identify who they are, we end up jeopardizing them, jeopardizing their well-being, and denying them a service that they're entitled to. So I really think that we have a commitment and an obligation to make sure that people are safe. I think we've seen incredible abuses of power at the federal level. And we need to, obviously, we're all living in rule of law again, and we need to obey the law. But I don't think we need to be in a position where we're collecting information and sharing information that is going to put at harm people who are at risk and have protected rights. And that's what I'll do as governor. I'll make sure that we treat all people with human dignity and make sure that they're safe.
Another percolating issue that comes up occasionally and still is relatively unresolved in Vermont. Should Vermont move to retail sales of marijuana?
You know, I think we made this decision years ago in terms of when we decriminalized. Marijuana is everywhere, and the problem is because we have failed to tax and regulate, we aren't in a position to build a thriving industry. We are losing revenues to other states, and frankly, that we're not capturing the revenues to support important state initiatives around prevention, education, public health, making sure we have strong systems of mental health and support. So I'm assuming this bill will pass and get signed. If not under Governor Scott, certainly under Mew's governor.
The pandemic in Vermont obviously has created a giant budget hole for the state, and I'm wondering how do you think the state is going to be able to work its way back from all these losses in revenue and increased expenses?
So I think I'm glad you asked this question. I think it feels particularly important today because we know that the unemployment insurance benefits, that extra $600 a week is running up. It's down. It's out now. And if you think about the fact that, you know, maybe if we have, you know, 440,000 people who are eligible in Vermont for that extra $600 a week, that's about $24 million a week that we are now losing from the Vermont economy. And when people have that money, they buy food in Vermont to feed their families. They pay their rent. They buy goods and services from other Vermont businesses. So losing this benefit is going to be significant. It's why I'm concerned that Governor Scott hasn't said that he said it's valuable to have that benefit and hasn't argued strongly to maintain those resources for Vermont, because it doesn't just help the people who are unemployed. It helps our entire Vermont economy. You know, and so I think there's several pieces to this, Dave. First of all, we're in a crisis now, and Scott's done a good job in the immediate crisis. I have some concerns around his ability to build the unemployment insurance system. But we need a long-term plan, because the bottom line is our economy is heavily focused on recreation and tourism. It's a wonderful sector, but it was the first to get hit by COVID. It'll be one of the slowest to come back. So we need to be thinking about opportunities to diversify our economy and to bring money that we currently spend out of state here in Vermont, where it can support and develop economic opportunity here and bring revenue into the state to support Vermonters. That's why I put out last week a proposal for a green energy transition. Thrilled that Vice President Biden has also proposed a $2 trillion investment in supporting this transition to local renewable green energy. And I really look forward to doing that, because right now we spend about $3 billion a year on out-of-state energy, including about $1.5 billion on fossil fuels. If we could redirect some of that into a green energy transition, electrification of energy here, we create great jobs that pay very good wages and build wealth, including in some of our rural communities, that strengthen opportunity and give people the means and the opportunity to live a good life right here in Vermont.
You have really gone after David Zuckerman, one of the other leading candidates for lieutenant governor. I mean, for governor. I'm going to get this right eventually. He's current lieutenant governor. He's running for governor, as are you. You really criticized him on his record on vaccines. Are you convinced that you are 100% right about that issue and that your treatment of it has been fair?
You know, it's funny. You know, I've been writing about all kinds of things, Dave, and talking about all kinds of issues. And this is the issue that the press seems to be very interested in as well. What I will say is I don't think I've said anything that hasn't been said before. And he's been very clear himself on his record. And, you know, I think the facts are the facts. I mean, as a Secretary of Education, you know, we know, and I've worked with, and as a school principal too, families whose children couldn't get vaccines because they had medical conditions that prevented them from getting it. Here's the bottom line. When we vaccinate our kids against diseases like measles that are common and that used to kill hundreds of kids, we keep people safe. And people don't talk about polio now. They don't talk about measles. They don't talk about whooping cough as much, precisely because our public health immunization programs have been so successful. And I grew up in places like Afghanistan where hundreds of people died every year because of these diseases. So I'm confident in the science on immunization. And I'm also confident that when you publicly dispute the value or the effectiveness of some of these initiatives in ways that raise questions in people's minds in well-proven, well-researched and documented public health initiatives, what it does is it makes people afraid of things that might actually save their lives and save the lives of their neighbors. It's the same thing with mask wearing. You need to wear a mask, not necessarily because it's going to keep you safe, but it might keep your neighbors safe as well. And we have to work together on these issues, and we have to be focused on peer-reviewed science, just as we were with seatbelts, just as we encourage people to wear helmets, because that's how we keep each other safe. And I still feel that very strongly. My commitment is to the health and well-being of Vermonters. And as we think about COVID-19 and the devastation it's creating in our economy, we need to know that all of our people will come together, look at the scientific evidence, and be very strategic and work in ways that help us come out from underneath COVID-19 as quickly and safely as we can.
Less than a minute to go. I just want to have one last question. If and when a COVID-19 vaccine is developed, should it be mandatory for people to be vaccinated?
You know, I think we've all seen that even if it is developed, it won't be available in broad doses. So we'll have to be very strategic in how we use it. But if there is a proven vaccine and our public health experts and our epidemiologists are confident in the research and believe in the value, I will absolutely work with them, starting with where it makes the biggest difference to ensure that we're keeping people safe. And that will be congregated settings, people who care for old people, people who we know need to be vaccinated to make sure we're not spreading the disease here in Vermont.
We just have a few seconds left. I want to thank you very much, Rebecca Holcomb, a Democratic candidate for governor of Vermont. And We'll, I expect to be talking again soon. Thank you very much, Rebecca Holcomb.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Good morning. Yes, good morning again. Actually, we are entering the second hour of the Dave Graham Show here on this Thursday, July the 30th, 2020. And I believe we're going to be speaking with Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News. In fact, he's on the phone with us already. Good morning, Leonard.
Yep, here I am. Good morning to you.
Welcome to the Dave Graham Show. Hey, interesting development just this morning. The president apparently tweeting that he might like to see the November election delayed. What's up with that?
Yeah, that's sort of a startling tweet. He can, of course, give himself a degree of plausible deniability by saying he was just merely speculating on Twitter. But let's unpack all of this for a moment. First, the president has no authority to delay the day of the election. That's in Congress's hand. It's, the election day is set by federal law, nor can he postpone the inauguration because that's in the Constitution, January 20th. So there's nothing he can do unilaterally, though you have to say that his decision to send federal authorities into cities around the country without the invitation of those cities suggests that he's willing to take certain means to be able to get his way, regardless of whether the rest of our political culture approves of it. But all that being said, yes, there's no way he can do it, but perhaps what he's really doing is signaling to his voters that he thinks the vote, if it goes Joe Biden's way, as the polls are suggesting, that he thinks the vote is illegitimate, that the election was rigged. And so whether he's trying to foment resistance to a Biden presidency, if Biden is duly elected, or whether he's simply trying to give himself an out and save face, if he does happen to lose, where he walks away from the White House saying, it was stolen from me, it was rigged, people stay on the cause because we got cheated. There are all sorts of ways to interpret this, but, you know, that's probably, to me, the most likely interpretation of what he's doing.
So that he would actually, if he does leave office, and remember, this is quite normal behavior for a president who's either getting done with his or her second term or a president who has lost a bid for reelection. I believe the last time that would happen was with George H.W. Bush in 1992, lost to President Bill Clinton as Bush was running for re-election, and there was a smooth transition of power there, from what I recall.
Yes, you have to hope that takes place. You have to hope that this just isn't sort of bluster and defensiveness and a way to save face. Look, we do know that President Trump, throughout his life, the last five-letter word he wants associated with him is loser. So if he happens to lose to Joe Biden, and again, we can discuss whether, you know, Joe Biden is a slam dunk because of these polls or whether this election is a lot more tight than people currently believe. But if he happens to lose, he doesn't want to accept the label loser. And so he's trying to defend himself against being called a loser by saying he really didn't lose, that the election was rigged, that mail-in balloting is fraudulent, which there's no evidence to suggest that it is. So this is how I think he's positioning it, because ultimately, in the long run, I don't think he'll be happy leaving office, but I personally believe that he will leave office, though I don't think his administration will be highly cooperative with an incoming Biden administration if that takes place.
Yeah, they believe that the last administration was investigating them improperly, et cetera, at that transition. You know, the famous Obama-Russiagate thing that the Trump administration and some of his allies have tried to promote, and especially in the last year or so since the Mueller investigation got done. Do you feel as though that he's going to consider himself justified for in any efforts that he might make to make a transition here as ugly as possible?
Well, if he believes or if he claims or argues and tells his supporters that he should be president, that the vote was stolen or was fraudulent, that the system was rigged, then, you know, he may well not want to cooperate because that'll be yet another act of defiance that has helped him gain so much popularity among his voters. And do keep this in mind. You bring up the Russia issue. Attorney General Barr has authorized an investigation of the investigators of Russia, of the Russia situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that report will likely come out before the election. And, you know, that may give more ammunition because Barr has shown himself to be a fairly partisan attorney general. That may give the president more ammunition to say that the Democrats and the deep state have been trying to undermine his presidency from even before day one, and therefore he has no incentive to cooperate with those people when they take power illegitimately because they stole the election through mail-in balloting, which is perhaps one argument that can take place. Now, the hope is that he's gracious, and the hope is that he will sort of say, I don't believe this happened. This shouldn't have happened. I should have won. The balloting was rigged. But for the health of the nation, I'll do my best to cooperate with the incoming administration. You have to hope that's the case. But his sort of delay in acknowledging John Lewis's death over the past week, his unwillingness to say anything more about John Lewis suggests that anyone who crosses his path in a way he doesn't like, he won't do much to reach out or be gracious or to cooperate. So, you know, you never know what will happen. You have to hope that he will be gracious even if he resists the results. But certainly the opposite is possible.
The president tweeted about voters should support him because he's promising a quote-unquote suburban lifestyle dream that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood, unquote. What's that about?
Well, you have to imagine that he's revisiting the 1968 playbook of Richard Nixon or George Wallace and thinking that he can scare a lot of white suburbanites into not moving toward the Democratic Party, which they had been for a while now, into suggesting that, hey, if Joe Biden gets into the White House, you will no longer have your pristine suburbs and all of these people of color, low income, will be moving in and disrupting your communities the same way that they're disrupting the cities right now, which is why he would argue we have to send in federal authorities to restore law and order. So this is right out of the Nixon-Wallace playbook. But the truth is that suburbs around the country have been diversifying for many, many years. That's one of the untold stories of our demographics. So it's not the same old lily-white suburbs that you had in the 1960s when a Nixon or Wallace could scare people based on whatever racial fears they may have had. So, you know, what he's saying also is in some ways a violation of the lessons that suburban parents teach their kids, which is to respect and embrace diversity and inclusion. So he's running a very sort of risky, potentially dated campaign with the hope that he can pull back some of those white suburbanites who have been drifting toward the Democratic Party because they may well be the margin of difference in certain battleground states in November. So I think that's a strategy. And at the same time, keep this in mind, too. His campaign has been actually advertising to African Americans and targeting African Americans in certain battleground states, stoking fear about Joe Biden because Joe Biden was the author of the much hated among the African American community 1994 crime bill, which increased mass incarceration of so many African Americans. So he's trying to play it at both ends, pull black votes away from Biden and potentially get them not to vote the way many didn't vote in 2016, and scare white suburbanites by using a reverse form of racism, suggesting that their communities will be ruined.
Well, it's quite a strategy out there. Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks as always. Always enjoy it.
Alrighty. Had to let Leonard Steinhorn go because I know CBS News likes to limit the time they can have their correspondents on with any individual station, understandably. But I do have a caller from Williamstown, Rama. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, listen, I just called up. I just want to say hope is not a solution to this. Hope is not a path forward. And anybody that's saying we just have to hope, excuse me, there's a truck going by. Anybody who thinks that the solution to the likes of Trump, McConnell, GOP, VT, GOP, and their racist, fascist tendencies, if they say and hope is a possible solution to this mess, they're totally wrong and they're misleading us. So, but, you know, it's action that's going to work, not hope.
Action that's going to work, not hope. What kinds of action are needed, Rama?
Well, listen, I would be, if you give me enough time to sit on the air with you someday, I'll be happy to go through and start talking particulars. But until then, I need to just leave it at pithy little statements, because that's really the only time that I have in a short phone call to get through. So, you know, you want to give me a half hour on the radio someday, I'd be more than happy to go through in depth and in detail why I say things I say and what I believe can be done with it.
Okay, well, we'll try that maybe sometime, Rama. Thanks for the call today. Last Friday, I had a guest on talking about the struggles of a health club in central Vermont. It's now called Green Mountain Community Fitness. It's up in Berlin. It's where the old First and Fitness used to be, and was bought back in January. One of the purchasers, Nick Pedersen, was my guest on Friday. We were talking about how they're bringing in some sort of related businesses to promoting health. And one of the things he mentioned was veterinary acupuncture. And I said, that's a thing? And it got me to thinking, there's a lot of really amazing stuff that goes on in Vermont, stuff I've never heard of, and I suspect that many of our listeners haven't either. And all sorts of interesting lines of work here, and who knows, just different things, household gadgets you might. I actually love going to the Tunbridge Fair and the History Pavilion there, because you see all these gadgets that they used to use in the old days, but there's new stuff coming out all the time for different tasks that people have maybe struggled with for years, and somebody says, there's got to be an easier way to do this, I'm going to invent something new. They come out with something really strange, and my reaction sometimes is, that's a thing? So whether it's a household gadget or a line of work or really anything, I would love for our listeners out there to email us here at the Dave Graham Show, dgshow@radiovermont.com, and suggest ideas for a new segment that I want to organize here on a fairly regular basis called That's a Thing? And we're going to try that approach to today, that sort of a sense of amazement and wonder at what goes on out there in the world. And today's subject for That's a Thing is veterinary acupuncture. I'm sure most folks have heard of acupuncture as a health treatment, but it's actually being used with animals. And so we're going to hear about that from a couple of folks today. I think we're going to be speaking first off with Erica Bruner. She's a veterinarian who has a business devoted to veterinary acupuncture. And I want to hear all about it. So Erica Bruner, I believe, is on the phone with us. Good morning, Erica.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
And let me ask, let me make sure I understand first off, is veterinary acupuncture your main thing, or is it just, do you have a sort of, you know, what people think of as a regular veterinary practice that then does some acupuncture?
Well, it's actually about half of what I do. The other half is end-of-life care, which I usually do with house calls, and that might be consultations about end-of-life care for pets that are in that stage,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes just home euthanasia for folks. So those are the kind of two aspects of my practice. I used to be a general practitioner. I started doing that in central Vermont in 2002, but in 2017, I decided to focus my practice on those two aspects, which really are the ones that kind of call to me the most. So I've stopped doing general practice.
I see. Okay. You know, and it is interesting to me because, I mean, I sort of think to myself, well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I actually might have used your services a couple of years ago. We had a dog who ended up dying and was in that sort of end stage for a while. And we, you know, we wondered kind of how to respond to the situation and you know, when to finally make a decision to have the dog go. Have the dog put to sleep, et cetera, and, you know, very tough thing for many, many pet owners when you get to that stage. And having somebody guide you through it who's well practiced at it might be a smart thing to do. So there, that's you know, again, I guess one reaction there would be to say that's a thing also. But you know, I don't want to make light of it because obviously that's a tough time in many pet owners and pets' lives. So, but veterinary acupuncture, again, it makes sense when I think of it because if people can benefit from acupuncture, then, you know, these dogs and cats, et cetera, are generally mammals. I guess there are some pets that aren't mammals, but we can talk about whether turtles can get acupuncture in a moment.
They can.
Wow. okay. So, I wanted to ask you, you know, is this a thriving thing? Or, I mean, how do people first learn about veterinary acupuncture and, are they beating your door down?
Well, you know, I do have at this point probably a new client every week or two. So yeah, I would say it is an actively growing thing. There are other vets in Vermont that do this, and you know, I know they're busy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what was the other part of your question?
Well, I was just mainly trying to figure out.
Where do my referrals come?
Yeah,
from?
How do you get the word out and that sort of thing?
It's two things. Sometimes it's people are calling me because they've benefited themselves from acupuncture, and they would really like their animal to benefit. So I get referrals from local acupuncturists.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes it's the local veterinary clinic that will refer folks, especially if they're seeing that the animals may be struggling with some issues that conventional medicine hasn't been as helpful for as people would like, or that maybe they see the person's bent is, you know, kind of a little bit away from conventional medicine, more interested in a more alternative therapy. So it's probably about split the referrals that I get, some from the acupuncture community and some from the veterinary community.
Now, I think we have a client of yours calling in on the other line. Let me get a word from Mike D'Onofrio. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Do I have that right? Are you a client of Erica Bruner and her veterinary acupuncture practice?
Yeah, that's true. Our dog, Dustin, is a client.
Wow, okay. And why did you decide your dog needed acupuncture?
So he's 16. He's a lab mix.
Mm-hmm.
He's had like a very, very active life until he was about 11 or 12. He was always out, you know, in the woods with us, skiing, jogging, mountain biking, you know, going top speed. So he's aged well, but in the last maybe year, we've noticed that his back end in particular has just looked really, you know, weak and stiff. And my wife, Kelly, you know, knew about Erica's practice. And we decided to give it a try as something to, you know, provide some relief and flexibility.
And the how has it worked? Have you had success with this?
Yeah, definitely. We see Erica every, you know, maybe 10 days to 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very noticeable how, you know, as we get closer to the appointment, his movement just looks a lot stiffer. He just looks a lot older in the way that he moves. And generally when we get home from an appointment and get him out of the car, he runs around the yard and like rolls around in the grass, and you know, it's like it rejuvenates him.
Huh. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So have you, is this something you've talked to your friends about and said, hey, you know, your dog might benefit from acupuncture, or your cat might benefit from acupuncture as well?
I have told a couple of friends of mine who have, you know, their dogs are not yet to our dog's point, but mm-hmm. they're like kind of similar. Like they're dogs that they've had for years, had them out on the trails. They're starting to show their age a bit. I always mention, you know, this is something that just from the eyeball test is working for us.
Yeah, that is, and how did you first hear about this or think about it, or how did it occur to you to go get your dog? And by the way, what's your dog's name?
His name is Dustin.
Dustin, okay.
Yep.
And so how did it occur to you to get Dustin treated with acupuncture?
Erica might actually be able to answer that better than me, oddly enough, because I'm pretty sure the initial connection was between Erica and my wife, Kelly. Erica, do you remember how we got started?
Yeah, I think maybe Kelly heard about the kind of end-of-life side of my practice, and the first time I met you guys was at a house call, which I did to do kind of like end-of-life evaluation and consultation about, you know, how to improve his comfort. And so we didn't start off with acupuncture right away. We looked at some other stuff, but it seemed pretty clear that mobility was a big issue for him and that acupuncture would be useful. So that is how we got going.
Yeah, so we figured, you know, give it a shot, you know, try it once and see what happens. And it was really like what I described. It was like from the, you know, before the appointment to after the appointment was just a noticeable difference in, you know, how Dustin was behaving.
Wow. So, yeah. And how did Dustin behave in the appointment with the acupuncture actually going on?
Well, he loves it because he gets just fed a steady stream of treats to keep him, you know, relatively still. So when we take him, it's basically the only place we ever take him in the car is Erica's office.
Yeah.
So
okay.
When we start to get ready to go in the car, he's like, let's go. And, you know, I think it feels weird to him from the way that he moves around as some of the needles are being applied. It clearly doesn't hurt him because he doesn't, you know, yelp or flinch.
Yeah.
But he's so distracted by the treats that I think for him it's overall it's like a, you know, a day at the beach.
That sounds like, I don't know. I guess I wouldn't. Next time I go for acupuncture, I'm going to ask for a steady stream of treats too. That'll be good. Vastly improved the experience, but
definitely.
And yeah, that is pretty funny, I gotta say. Mike D'Onofrio, I appreciate you getting on the air with us on short notice and providing a little testimonial here. I think it's very helpful for folks out there to understand that not only are there practitioners out there doing this, but there are happy customers and dog pet owners who are going in for they're bringing their animals in for veterinary acupuncture, and that is that's pretty cool. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. You know, like I said, it's just the results are just very, very tangible and clear to the eye with our pet.
Uh-huh.
And Erica is super, super wonderful to deal with on top of it all. So
well, that's great.
Yep.
All righty. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, you bet.
Erica Bruner, I'm wondering, we've heard a story about an elderly dog who gets kind of vivified or whatever, you know, rejuvenated mm-hmm. by acupuncture treatments. Are there other pet issues, health issues, or behavioral issues that also can be addressed with acupuncture?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as you could imagine, given the kind of orientation of my practice being toward end-of-life care,
mm-hmm.
And I've always had a special fondness for old animals,
mm-hmm.
so they do make up the majority of my acupuncture patients.
I see, okay. Well,
but I have also treated younger animals with acute injuries, like especially back pain and neck pain is something that really responds well to acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
I have treated dogs with allergies. I haven't had a chance to treat as many of those yet. And then, you know, they do use acupuncture for people for kind of psychological issues such as depression and PTSD.
That's what I want to ask about, but we have to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. We're going to continue our conversation with a veterinarian and veterinary acupuncturist, Erica Bruner, after our bottom of the hour break. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back shortly.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
This is one of our, it's a new thing on the Dave Graham Show. We're calling it our That's a Thing segment. We're going to try to make a regular thing out of it. Well, we need help from some of our listeners out there. You got to email in suggestions to dgshow@radiovermont.com. Radio Vermont, one word, all spelled out. And let us know what you'd like to hear about it. Things out there that are going on, they're kind of unusual, and people may have not have thought of them, but then they think about them, and they go, huh, it kind of makes sense. Here we go. Our conversation today is about veterinary acupuncture, and we are speaking with Erica Bruner. She is a veterinarian who offers acupuncture as well as end-of-life care for pets and their owners. That relationship is such a key thing. And actually, Erica, before we get back to the questions, I wanted to ask you about some kind of behavioral psychological care for pets with acupuncture. Talk to me a little bit about the end-of-life services that you provide, because my impression is, you know, it's obviously tough for animals, any living thing that is approaching the end of life. Often there's pain involved, there's illness, there is, all sorts of issues like that. But when it's a dog or a cat who is in the last stage of life, oftentimes suffering, it's a really, really tough thing for the owner of that pet to make a decision about maybe putting the pet down. Do you talk and work with owners about that stuff as well?
You know, sometimes people call me when they already know and they're ready for euthanasia, and so that can be very, you know, fairly straightforward. I mean, it certainly has a lot of feeling, of course, that goes with it, but maybe not so much the struggle of the decision. Then there are other times where, you know, maybe people have been through a decision before, but it wasn't like this one, or maybe they've never been through a decision before. I think it's especially hard when someone is gradually declining because there's so much we don't know. You know, we don't really know exactly how they feel. We don't know how they feel about what's going on for them. Often people don't know what the options are for their pets. And then if you add in the fact that, you know, these usually older pets who quite often over time have developed an understandable dislike for going into the vet clinic. And so even though people could use some help from a veterinarian, they're understandably reluctant to bring them into a clinic, stress them out. You know, and maybe they already know that, well, you know, I don't want to do a lot of testing and intervention. I really just want a kind of quality of life, peaceful, you know, maybe symptom-based palliative care type approach.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also a big part of what I do. And sometimes a consult is really about that, about exactly what's going on medically and physically and how we might address that with some comfort measures. And other times the consultation is more on the sort of, you know, kind of like emotional, philosophical, moral side of things, because there's a whole bunch of that too. Like people mm-hmm. can feel very uncomfortable about making a euthanasia decision. It can often feel like playing God, or it can feel like an inappropriate decision for a human being to be making for another living being. So there's just a lot of struggle around that sometimes for people. These are hard decisions.
Yeah, that is for sure. I think we actually have another client on the line I wanted to check in with as well. I think it's Maura Quinn joining us. And good morning, Maura.
Yes, it is. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Maura, tell us how you use Erica's veterinary acupuncture services, and have they been helpful first of all, actually, I should ask you, you have a dog or a cat?
Sorry, it's a little loud. They're doing some road work around here, and I'm outside because my other dogs want me to go to the woods with them, and they're barking at me if I don't take them.
Oh, okay.
So I'm hiding in the corner right now telling you that Boris, our standard poodle, who's 9 years old, he started developing, this EM. Erica could tell you exactly what it is, but where his back legs weren't getting the signal that they were supposed to be getting to function. And we spent a lot of money on over at Bev with x-rays and all sorts of other analysis of what was wrong with him. And there wasn't anything wrong that they could see physically, like a muscle or bone or anything like that. But it was this nerve issue was the only other possibility, they thought. And it was very upsetting because he was a very active dog. And I don't know if you've ever seen standard poodles run, but when they're really in full flight, they're like they go bouncing and just leaping. And he wasn't doing that.
Mm-hmm.
He was just really slowed up. And I take him walking every day, all three of my dogs. And it was very upsetting because that's my boy,
Yeah,
Boy Boris.
It's
amazing. I did some research because nothing else was going to help. And I was like, well, so did some research and met with Erica, and she told us how she had tendonitis? And she wasn't able to get any kind of help, and then she did acupuncture, and it worked for her, and so she thought maybe it'll work for pets, and so that reassured me, and it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing the difference between where he was back in November and where he is now. I was concerned about what's it going to be like in the winter, and basically, it didn't. We kept going out every day. We were able to continue. And, I'm so immensely grateful that she's there and that this process works because, I love him.
Yeah, sure. Well, Maura, that's a fine testimonial. I really appreciate you calling in this morning and checking in with us. It's good talking with you, and best of luck with your three dogs and your daily walks with them. I hope they stay healthy for a long time.
Me too.
Alrighty. All right. Hey, Erica Bruner is my guest. She is a veterinarian, also a veterinary acupuncturist. And Erica, tell me, I probably should have asked the story on my own, but Maura kind of prompts me here. You had a case of tendonitis, you got acupuncture yourself, found it successful, and that's how you decided, hey, let's try with this with animals. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I actually, as a veterinarian, was really never interested in alternative medicine and kind of, thought that acupuncture was fairy dust, and sometimes people would ask me for a recommendation for their dogs, and I would give them names of people that I knew that did acupuncture for pets, but inside I was thinking, like, oh, that probably doesn't work, or, so I really had no belief in it at all, and mm-hmm. I developed this elbow tendonitis that was basically debilitating. Like, at a certain point, it took me, I had to use two hands to pick up a glass of water.
Wow.
It was painful every night. I would wake up in the middle of the night in pain, and, I went to see occupational therapist, who was great, but I had this ongoing inflammation. They couldn't really work with me. I saw some surgeons. It's not really a surgical condition, and after a couple of years of really not being able to do things that I wanted to do and having trouble also, doing work, like nail trims were especially bad. I finally ended up kind of in desperation at, quote, the last house on the street, quote, which was, my acupuncturist, she became. And it took a while for me to improve because it had been going on for a long time at that point. But not only did my elbows get better and my pain resolve, but also other things in my life that I thought I just kind of had to deal with, like, sometimes have episodes of low mood, trouble sleeping, maybe some mild digestive stuff. It's really, none of it was bad enough to need Western medicine. And that stuff started to get better for me too, which I didn't expect at all. And seeing that, and also seeing how basically simple, you know, it's sort of a minute to learn, a lifetime to master kind of thing, but in concept, acupuncture is fairly simple. It doesn't require a lot of fancy equipment. It doesn't require diagnostics, because in Chinese medicine, we work with the symptoms, you know, the kind of location of what's going on and what the quality is of what's going on there, and the pulse, which we can feel. And so I thought at that point I was a house call practitioner, and I was thinking, wow, this would be really great for house calls and for elderly pets, because it just doesn't, you know, they don't have to do a bunch of fancy diagnostics, and I could do it with anybody. So then I went off to the Qi Institute of Traditional Chinese Veterinary Medicine, which is in Redick, Florida, and they have a 6-month certification program for veterinarians. So I did that in 2016, and then I started doing acupuncture for pets.
Wow. So that is interesting. And you were telling me that there are a number of other acupuncturists, pet acupuncturists in Vermont as well. So I guess this really is a thing. It's something that I just wasn't familiar with before I first heard about it last week. Let's bring in a couple of callers. We have Nancy on the line from Morrisville. Good morning, Nancy.
And thank you. I have to tell your practitioner that I admire her choice of specialties. I have a philosophy that I learned from a plaque in a veterinarian's office many years ago that came from Roy Rogers, that the best doctor is a veterinarian because he can't ask questions about symptoms and problems. He just has to know. I've had several very long-lived pets, cats, dogs, who have benefited from acupuncture. And one example was our Labrador Retriever, who had dealt with Lyme disease and multiple myeloma with the expectation, and they were not simultaneous, with the expectation of approximately a year to live. Well, that girl lived about 3 years longer, to the age of 16, and she experienced great relief in general and in flexibility, mobility, and died pretty much of natural causes at the age of 16. We also had a cat who had come from a shelter and was pretty reticent retiring. So, you know, as the dog obviously had physical benefits, this cat really got psychological benefits from it. She would literally scream bloody murder when we first started the needles. But she was somebody, unusually a cat, who didn't want to be touched. But I'll tell you what, after those first couple, three needles went in, she just completely relaxed, ended up with probably about 15 needles, and she would sit so quietly for the 20 minutes, half hour of the treatment, and the result was absolutely noticeable. You could see the results. She was psychologically much more confident, had much greater ability in terms of physical. And as a sideline, after I had taken my pets, I myself benefited very much from acupuncture to help neck shoulder situation. Mm-hmm. So I really have to endorse veterinarians in general and acupuncture as well. And thank you for hearing me.
All righty. Well, thank you for the call. I've had a couple of emails here from a good friend and a WDEV colleague, Joel Nashman. His first email to me this morning, he was saying that he was on pins and needles waiting for the veterinary acupuncture segment of the radio program. But he later was actually asking about cats, and he said, my Bengal cat Cleo has 20 sharp needles of her own that an acupuncturist would have to avoid. Does she do cats? So, Erica Bruner, what's your answer to, I think we know the answer, but talk a little bit about cats.
Yes, I think cats are actually great patients, they respond really well to acupuncture. It often doesn't require as many needles to treat them as it might with a dog. There's something about being more sensitive, which is actually a benefit in treatment, because the more sensitive someone is, maybe the more challenging it might be to treat them, but the quicker they'll respond, and usually the less, you know, actual needles they might need. So most of my patients are dogs. I think that might have to do somewhat with folks' reluctance to leave the house, you know, with their cat to take them out to another place. But I do have some cat patients, and I use smaller needles with them. I go maybe a little bit more slowly with them, but they certainly are treatable. I have a friend from my acupuncture program. She was actually one of my instructors, and she's a feline-only practitioner in St. Augustine, Florida. And to see her treat cats, it's a thing of beauty, because she distracts them with little... I mean, we're really good at distracting with treats because we want to be their friend. Like, we don't want to force and compel them to undergo something that's stressful and miserable. We want them to enjoy it. So her technique is to use little bits of butter, and she distracts kitties with that and then places needles with ease. So I am working to become as effortless with cats as she is, but cats, you can treat cats too. People do worry about how their animal is going to tolerate the treatment, but most of the time I found that it's much better than anybody is worrying about.
Hmm. Let's bring in another listener calling in. It's Laura from Hyde Park. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
What's on your mind today?
So I first talked to Dr. Bruner back in April when my greyhound, Ernie, was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which is an aggressive form of bone cancer. I would go to the ends of the earth for my dog, as I think most pet owners these days would do. And I hadn't decided what I was going to do to treat him. Was I going to do an amputation? I'd heard a lot about acupuncture. My mother-in-law has dogs, and she's taken them to acupuncture. What I think Dr. Bruner brings to the table, besides performing the acupuncture itself, is her ability to explain things to, you know, us as pet guardians. We want to do our best. And what I also thought about Dr. Bruner was getting Ernie comfortable with her, as this form of cancer usually ends with you euthanizing your pet, because the cancer will spread even with aggressive treatment. So Dr. Bruner will come to our house when it's time to send Ernie off into the netherworld. So she's a remarkable human being and someone who I trust to ask. And I think what's nice about her is she performs the acupuncture, but you know she is a veterinarian. So she has all of this advice and all of this knowledge that you lean on to make the best decisions for your pet. So I can't say enough good things about her and her bedside manner as well. So she's truly a gem.
Well, there's quite a testimonial also.
Yeah, unsolicited. Thank you, Laura. Nice to hear you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, she's amazing. So I think for people too, it's like she was saying, they could use the help from a veterinarian's office, but at the end of life, when you're letting your pet go too, to have them be able to be in the comfort of their own home and on their bed and not having to bring them in for that last session. And I know some people don't have the opportunity to get to do that, but to have her have the service to you, you know, have that those last moments of peace with your dog, I think is just huge and wonderful.
All right. Well, Laura, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate that sort of spontaneous response we get occasionally from listeners who may not have known they were going to be calling this morning, but to hear something on the radio that prompts them to say, I'm going to speak up about that. That's a good thing. That's one of the fun things about this radio program, for sure. And Erica Bruner, I'm wondering if you're I did want to get into a little bit with you discussion about behavioral issues with pets, because there are dogs who are perhaps way younger in life, even toward the puppy end of the range, and people are trying to teach them not to jump on folks, not to bark furiously when somebody comes to the door, maybe, you know, and not to act aggressive or even biting. and that kind of thing early in life. Is there anything that a veterinary acupuncturist can do for those situations?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is a little trickier because to me, the physical complaints, especially pain, are probably more straightforward to treat. You know, the anatomy and physiology of dogs and cats is very similar to that of humans, and so making a transfer over from human Chinese medicine and acupuncture for various conditions to pets is fairly straightforward, just like it is often with medicine. You know, sometimes people are surprised to learn, oh, you use that? I thought that was a people medicine. Well, we can use it in pets too. When you're talking about those kind of psychological and behavioral things, I think it may be a little bit trickier. It may take a little bit longer to figure out the right approach. Chinese medicine treats the whole being. So when we look at what's going on, we can put things together, both physical symptoms and also kind of emotional behavioral symptoms together into a pattern, whether it's, you know, too much heat in one system or deficiencies in another system. So I would say that, you know, expecting a little bit more time to address that would be a good thing, but I think I have had less opportunities to treat those issues, but I really look forward to treating them. They're some of the most interesting and also some of the most widespread issues. I mean, the biggest reason for animals to get given up to shelters is for behavior reasons. So mm-hmm. If we can address that and help them stay in their homes and, of course, help them be happier, then that's, you know, a really good thing. And we want to use everything that we can to bring that about. So as a combination of an approach that might include a conventional veterinary behaviorist maybe or some training, especially for dogs, you know, with a competent trainer, positive reinforcement, those are all things that would help, and I think acupuncture could be part of that as well.
Hmm. And in terms of the, I guess I would ask then, order a battle, so to speak, for lack of a better phrase. But the first person you call is maybe not an acupuncturist, but would be a trainer, and then maybe a veterinary behaviorist, acupuncturist third on the list, or where does it sort of rank in that sense? For folks who are upset about, oh, geez, my dog just, you know, is chasing cars down the street again or something.
I think it really depends on what the issue is. You know, if you have a house soiling issue, there may well be a medical reason for that, and probably a conventional vet might be your first stop to rule out something like, you know, say a urinary tract infection or a urinary problem if someone is peeing in the house.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a situation where it's a young dog and they're maybe a little too exuberant when they greet visitors or too kind of, you know, anxious and fly off the handle when somebody comes to the house.
Yeah.
Getting more exercise, having some appropriate training, teaching people how to teach dogs what they want them to do, which is what trainers do. You know, maybe there's nothing physiologically wrong with that dog. Maybe they don't have an emotional disturbance. Maybe they just don't get enough activity in their day, and they need the person to give them a clear and consistent message of how they want the dog to behave. So that's really more of a trainer-type issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, say you have a dog who's just seems extremely anxious and flipped out about things that normal dogs tolerate easily, you know, that where the anxiety seems kind of pathological. I think that's probably, I mean, I would, you know, coming from my conventional veterinary background, I would always say, go visit your vet or talk to your vet first. But that's a kind of situation where I think acupuncture could be very relevant also.
Yeah, that sounds like sounds like another approach that could be tried for folks who maybe have tried others, or mm-hmm. maybe a first approach. That's that's interesting. Let me ask you a little bit about other animals, because obviously people have beyond dogs and cats. People have everything from ferrets to turtles to who knows. There's just a wide range of pets out there. Do you care? Apply acupuncture to other types of pets?
Yeah, you sure can. I mean, while I was doing the training program down at the Qi Institute in Florida, there were many times where we'd hear about animals other than pets. And, of course, they had a whole equine program for equine vets. But, you know, you mentioned turtles. We did hear about turtles being treated. Obviously, there are many points on a turtle that are under the shell that are hard to get to, but a lot of really important points are on the limbs, actually, from the elbows down and the knees down are some of the most important and powerful points in human and, you know, mammal acupuncture, and you can access all of those points on turtles. And once you know how to locate a point based on, you know, kind of anatomical landmarks, bony landmarks, and how to transfer that from the human, which is where the points have been known and located for thousands of years, to a pet, where we do have classical points that have been known and used for thousands of years in pets, but we also use a lot of what we, you know, points that we kind of transfer over from humans. Like if there's a bony landmark on the elbow, and that's how I locate the point on a person.
Fascinating, but we are about out of time. I really appreciate your time this morning, Erica Bruner. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. It was a great pleasure.
That's about it for the Dave Graham Show today, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our program. Stay tuned now for Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. Have a good afternoon, folks.